Dr. Al Benson is principal investigator of one of the most important clinical trials in colorectal cancer, ECOG 5202, a translational study that perhaps is a cousin to the Taylor X trial in breast cancer. I asked Dr. Benson to present a patient from his practice who entered the trial, and he told me about a young man.
I recently saw a 43-year-old male who had been in great health, but developed some rectal bleeding, and he visited his primary care physician, and the physician referred him in short order to the gastroenterologist for a colonoscopy. This man, by the way, did have a grandfather who had had colon cancer at a young age. On colonoscopy, he was noted to have an adenocarcinoma in the cecum and underwent a right hemicolectomy. And then he presented to me about 3 weeks after his surgery. In evaluating this individual on physical exam, there were really no significant findings. His incision was healing well. He had no other evidence of polyps, by the way, on his colonoscopy. And he did have a preoperative CEA, which was normal. In terms of his pathology features, he had a T3N0 lesion, and there were no classic risk factors in terms of pathologic review. So, in other words, he did not have evidence of lymphovascular invasion. It was a moderately differentiated tumor, and he had 22 lymph nodes sampled, and they were all negative. So, by classic pathologic features, this individual would be considered a fairly low-risk stage 2 patient.
Can you talk a little bit about his life situation, what kind of work he did, his family situation?
He was a businessman, married with a couple of children, and really he's a quite vigorous individual, and only with probing did he even think about his family history of colon cancer. When I saw him, we had a lengthy discussion. First of all, I talked with him about his family history and how I strongly recommended that he undergo genetic counseling, because it is possible with his age, a right-sided tumor, family history, that he does have hereditary non-polyposis colon cancer or Lynch syndrome.
What are the ages in terms of patients and relatives that get your attention?
Well, first of all, with Lynch syndrome, the individuals who develop colon cancer are younger patients in general. Certainly a 43-year-old male, if you look at the curve in terms of incidence of colon cancer based on age, we start seeing that there is a gradual increased slope starting at age 40. But nonetheless, his age would be of concern. And the fact that he had at least one fairly close relative, I think, is sufficient to warrant his seeking genetic counseling.
Did he do that?
He's going to do that.
Right.
He has not yet gone to the genetic counselor. And what we then talked about is risk assessment. And I outlined for him that by classic pathologic features, including the number of lymph nodes that he had sampled, that he would be considered a fairly low-risk individual, and that on that basis, he would not ordinarily receive chemotherapy. He was concerned, however, about his risk, particularly that he was young and was concerned about both recurrence as well as developing new colon cancers. And then I spent a great deal of time presenting to him the intergroup stage 2 clinical trial E5202, which is a very large study. It will certainly be the largest of its kind to collect tumor samples for individuals, and the first of its kind to use molecular markers to define a treatment strategy. And the markers used in this particular project are microsatellite instability and 18q loss of heterozygosity. And these markers were chosen because there are a number of retrospective analyses from patients with colon cancer which have strongly suggested that these are important prognostic markers. So in this particular trial, we are defining risk on the basis of these particular genetic markers. Now, because we are collecting such a large sample of tumors, this will open the door for many other analyses, including molecular markers, and we will also incorporate in multivariate analysis pathologic features in addition.
I guess we should mention that you're the principal investigator. Where are things right now in terms of accrual compared to where you want to be in the end?
Well, the study is accruing very well. This was an enormous challenge because we had to provide a number of education materials because oncologists and patients, at least for colon cancer, have not been used to the idea of a risk assessment model using molecular markers. So we partnered with patient advocacy groups. We had many discussions with both community and academic physicians who were instrumental in helping us create these materials and explaining such to patients and physician colleagues alike. Once that was all in place.
So could I just clarify, though, right now about what's the accrual and what's your target accrual?
We have now accrued over 1,600 patients. The total accrual goal is 3,600. And at our current accrual rate, we expect this to be completed within roughly 2 years.
And can you review the design of the study?
Well, what happens, and this was a challenge in and of itself, that we had to be able to collect tumor tissue very rapidly. That tissue is sent to the ECOG Pathology Coordinating Center, and then in turn, after processing, the tissue is sent to Stan Hamilton's lab at MD Anderson. So we have quality control in terms of our marker assessment, and Stan's lab is able to turn around these results very rapidly. So in the design, we need to have the tissue sent no later than day 50 after surgery, and that gives us enough of a window so that patients who are designated as high risk can begin their chemotherapy by day 60. So patients who retain 18q, and this heavily drives the analysis of risk, are those that are considered low risk. And so the microsatellite instability patients and those who retain 18q are low risk. And if our hypothesis is correct, those individuals would have a projected survivorship of nearly 90%. So the low-risk group is observed. The high-risk group, and for the most part, those are individuals who have microsatellite stable tumors and have 18q loss of heterozygosity, they are randomized to receive either FOLFOX or FOLFOX plus bevacizumab. This strategy is identical to the strategy employed in NSABP-C08, which included both stage 2 and 3 patients, although selection was not on the basis of marker determination. Nonetheless, those individuals were also randomized to FOLFOX with or without bevacizumab.
And of course, we're hoping we're going to see some maybe initial results on that in the near future. But the NSABP has already presented some safety data. And just as sort of a sidebar before we get back to this patient, I mean, with 1,600 patients, do you have any safety data yet?
Well, we have been evaluating safety data continuously, and we do receive a lot of queries from institutions, and thus far in our toxicity assessment, there have been no surprises. And I think that is consistent with the NSABP observations with FOLFOX and bevacizumab.
I'm curious, though, in terms of what you think about that, because I actually was kind of, I thought that the safety data actually looked maybe almost even better than maybe we expected, certainly in terms of bowel perforation and arterial events. What were your take on those data?
Well, those events are fortunately relatively uncommon, but it is reassuring, particularly in a post-operative patient population. And as most adjuvant patients are treated somewhere between 28 and 60 days after surgery, so that would be a potential concern in terms of wound healing, changes in the anastomosis, for example. But we haven't seen anything unusual thus far.
And I guess that was the other thing about the NSABP data. I think there were some events there, but it didn't look like a gigantic problem. Is that kind of your take?
That is my assessment, which gave us encouragement, certainly, to continue 5202 as designed. Another encouraging factor is that Dan Sargent recently presented data evaluating over 1,000 stage 2 patients who participated in adjuvant clinical trials. And his data looked at mismatch repair. And there is, by the way, about 97% concordance with evaluation of deficient mismatch repair and MSI. And what his data demonstrated was that 5-FU did not appear to be beneficial for the patients with stage 2 disease who were MSI positive or who had deficient mismatch repair. And that certainly supports the strategy for 5202, that these individuals do not appear to require adjuvant therapy, at least 5-FU adjuvant therapy, and that their survivorship should be quite good. And there is a suggestion, if anything, that giving 5-FU to such a patient may in fact be detrimental. So this just fully supports the observation arm in 5202, and we continue to focus then on the high-risk patients to see if we can improve their survivorship. What we hope from this particular clinical trial, because we will be able to analyze a host of factors, not only the molecular characteristics, and probably some we're not even aware of at this time, but also the pathologic features of these individuals to see what really stands out in terms of risk assessment. And given the heterogeneity of colon cancer, it wouldn't be surprising if we identified different profiles of individuals at various risks. But I think by doing so in this particular trial, we will be much better able in the end to inform patients about risk.
So what happened with this man?
This man decided to participate in 5202, and he was assigned low-risk status. He does have microsatellite instability. He was comfortable with the use of molecular profile to define his risk, which is why he agreed to participate, and he was very comfortable with observation, which, of course, will include standard surveillance. In addition, I talked to him about the frequency of his colonoscopy. Currently, it is standard practice to obtain a colonoscopy 1 year after surgery. However, if in fact he does have Lynch syndrome, he understands that his colonoscopies will be much more frequent, and he also understands that family members would need discussion in terms of risk and evaluation for Lynch syndrome.
You know, the other effort that seems to me to be in a similar direction is what the NSABP is doing, trying to kind of reduplicate what they did in breast cancer, looking at RT-PCR, and I guess Mike O'Connell and working with the people from Genomic Health. Can you talk a little bit about that effort and what's going on there and what you think about it and how it sort of intersects with what you're doing?
Well, I think it's a very important area. There have been a number of gene profiles presented from relatively small numbers of patients, certainly in Europe and in the United States. And I think one of the challenges will be what particular profile is most likely to predict outcome. With Genomic Health, they are, I believe, doing absolutely the right type of clinical investigation by partnering with investigators conducting large adjuvant trials to determine if these profiles are prognostic and perhaps predictive of benefit from therapy. So, in fact, for 5202, we're certainly speaking with investigators, including Genomic Health, about possible interaction. So when I talk about the ability to introduce other genetic testing in 5202 in multivariate analysis, this is exactly what I mean. So we don't believe this will end with just MSI 18q determination, but in fact opens the door to many interactions. It's a little bit early now, I think, to make the decision as to which additional molecular profiles we will integrate into 5202, because we project at least a number, two more years of accrual, and then, of course, we have to get the outcome data. So we will have the opportunity to look what evolves over the next few years to make a decision.
Let's talk a little bit about metastatic disease, and you mentioned a 62-year-old woman who had completed adjuvant FOLFOX about a year ago for stage 3 disease who presented with two liver mets in the right lobe of the liver. Can you talk a little bit about her?
This was an individual who actually was a stage 3C patient. She had multiple lymph nodes that were positive. She actually tolerated her adjuvant therapy quite well. And when she presented, this was really under surveillance. And she did have a bump in her CEA. And when she had her CT scan, she had these two right lobe of the liver lesions. So this raises a number of different issues here in terms of what is the potential to cure this individual, what is the most optimal strategy in terms of enhancing our ability to cure, what do you do when a patient has recurred after an adjuvant regimen like FOLFOX? So if you're making a chemotherapy decision, what would be the best chemotherapy platform? And should such an individual also receive biologics?
So, I guess in this situation, too, I presume that she was pretty straightforward, that she could have been resected or not necessarily?
Yes. So this is a situation where bringing back the surgeons right from the get-go upon discovery of isolated liver lesions is very important. Because what we want to know are the technical issues. Does the individual indeed have resectable lesions? And if the patient were to receive neoadjuvant chemotherapy and say the patient had a complete response, what would the surgeons do at that point? Would they carry out a planned surgical procedure? Or would they choose to observe, knowing that there was a substantial risk that these lesions would declare themselves again? What we have learned is in individuals who may have had a clinical complete response from neoadjuvant therapy, when those individuals do go back and have resection, the majority of those patients will still have evidence of residual tumor cells. So I think we would be hard-pressed to argue that chemotherapy alone would be curative. So for this individual, you could argue, since the surgeon said they could readily resect now, you could argue 1 year after completing adjuvant therapy that this individual should go to surgery and then consider additional chemotherapy postoperatively. If you look at guidelines, including NCCN, there are other alternatives that do include a neoadjuvant regimen. When people are thinking about neoadjuvant therapy, I think what needs to be decided up front is this patient resectable now, which would best fit the definition of neoadjuvant therapy, or is the person potentially resectable but not optimally at this time? And what you hope is with chemotherapy, you will convert the patient to resectability, hence the term conversion chemotherapy. And in the patient we're addressing now, this individual who had 3-centimeter lesions, we would be discussing a neoadjuvant strategy. The other component of this is what we have learned is that most people who receive chemotherapy enjoy their best response within 2 to 3 months of therapy. And so there's really not a need to continue therapy for longer than that if you have a resectable patient. In addition, what we've also learned from studies with both oxaliplatin and irinotecan, that there can be liver toxicity with these chemotherapy agents, and therefore, it's another reason to offer a relatively confined course of chemotherapy prior to surgery.
Now, did you have a KRAS on this patient, and did you biopsy the liver?
The liver was biopsied to confirm metastatic disease, and she has wild-type KRAS. So with this individual who was comfortable receiving chemotherapy first, our surgeons often argue that another advantage of giving chemotherapy first is to make sure that these lesions are chemosensitive, and also, and perhaps most importantly, that the patient will not go on to develop rapidly progressive disease. And the introduction of chemotherapy will give you that window of opportunity to observe the patient for a little longer.
So what happened with this woman?
Well, we had a discussion of what regimen to choose. I did inform her that the addition of biologics, whether cetuximab or bevacizumab, could improve the response rate. On the other hand, I emphasize that we didn't really need a significant response in her because she was already resectable, and that there are certainly potential toxicities with the biologics. So when she reviewed all of her options, she chose FOLFIRI, and the plan now is to give 4 cycles, and then we will reassess. This is also a situation where I think PET scanning is appropriate, and she did have a PET scan, and all that is demonstrated on the PET scan is the evidence of 2 lesions in the liver.
And what about post-op? What would you be thinking, assuming she goes through surgery okay?
There again, we do not have definitive evidence as to what is the best strategy. I think one approach is to view this as a sandwich strategy so that you give part of the chemotherapy prior to surgery and part after surgery. And I think for people who show evidence of response with neoadjuvant chemotherapy, that demonstrates that the individual appears to have a chemosensitive tumor. And I think a strategy of giving additional chemotherapy after that would be important. Now, if you had a patient who seemed to have no benefit from the chemotherapy or perhaps even had a little growth but was still resectable, I think that's a harder decision because there you would postulate that perhaps the chemotherapy didn't offer substantial benefit. And so what do you do post-op? Do you add a biologic? Do you change your chemotherapy platform? Those questions currently are unanswered.
So let's take the same sort of clinical situation in terms of where the lesions are and the resectability, but say instead of her being 62, she's 72. Instead of being a year after adjuvant therapy, it's 4 years after adjuvant therapy. Would that change whether or not you want to do pre-op therapy? In other words, as the patient gets older and maybe farther away from the diagnosis, maybe instead of having a bunch of nodes, she only had one or two nodes, does that make you, you know, maybe think less about pre-op therapy or not really?
Well, you're right that someone who presents 4 years post-initial surgery historically has a better prognosis and a better chance of long-term gain with surgical resection of isolated liver metastases. I don't make decisions on the basis of age per se, but rather what are the comorbid conditions, what is the performance status, and by and large, if I think someone can tolerate a liver resection, I think they probably will be able to tolerate chemotherapy. However, in this situation, if someone has resectable disease 4 years after initial surgery, I wouldn't feel strongly about giving neoadjuvant therapy. I do think they are in a better risk group. It is also perfectly appropriate to consider a neoadjuvant approach for the reasons that I mentioned, that, you know, you would have some reassurance, is the disease chemosensitive, and also the reassurance that this is not a rapidly progressive metastatic situation.
In this situation with this woman, obviously the concern is that maybe she's going to go through the pain and morbidity of having a hepatic resection and then just turn around a few months later and have disease in her lung or, you know, more liver mets and, you know, having gone through that kind of experience without it helping her.
Correct. And I think that's why surgeons and medical oncologists have embraced this overall concept. What we hope in the long run that our clinical trials will inform us better in terms of how to select patients. What are the advantages or disadvantages of neoadjuvant followed by adjuvant therapy in these situations? Although, you know, we've had some promising leads, we clearly have a lot more to figure out for this population.
Your group reported, and we actually have been doing some education programs now in HCC, which I know is another interest of yours, but your group has reported on the, you know, yttrium 90 microspheres. What's your experience been with that in both liver mets from colorectal cancer or other liver mets and also primary HCC?
Well, we've had a long-standing interest in collaborating with our interventional radiologists. I strongly believe that these so-called devices are certainly therapeutic interventions and therefore should be evaluated in terms of prospective trials. And this has been an enormous challenge. However, we have conducted trials in HCC, and another excellent model for liver-directed therapy, which includes patients with neuroendocrine lesions to the liver. And we've done a lot of work, particularly with yttrium microspheres, which has generated safety data, but also we've certainly identified patients who have enjoyed benefit from the intervention. In this particular project, we were very interested in colon cancer patients, particularly those who had received all active systemic interventions. And we are concerned about this population because I think we're seeing more and more people who have progressed after receiving all standard regimens.
Yes. I guess nowadays people are getting there a little quicker if they're with the KRAS because, you know,
yes,
you're knocking that right out in terms of anti-EGFR antibodies.
Absolutely. And so this creates a challenge for us because we have the KRAS mutated population and then a population that otherwise may have received all active agents but have liver metastases as the site of metastatic disease. And what do you do? Well, I think an important strategy will be to design clinical trials looking at other biological profiles for the mutated KRAS patient and exploring the utility of other biologic agents for this population. And in fact, this type of phase two design, looking at multiple different agents, is something that's emerging. But in this situation with liver-dominant metastases, we also thought it was worthwhile to see if yttrium-90 had any role. We had done work, as have others, with chemoembolization, where the results were not overly impressive, and by and large, chemoembolization is not something I would usually offer such a patient. But in this particular series of patients who had had chemotherapy and then yttrium-90, it does suggest that there are patients who can benefit from this approach. So the challenge is going to be patient selection in the future and to continue to study this to see if this might add to the survival benefits that we've seen with systemic approaches.
Now, has any consideration been given to using this strategy in a patient like the one you described, but maybe somebody who has, you know, maybe the patient's not resectable because it's abutting against, you know, a critical structure, surgeon wants you to shrink it down. Have these yttrium spheres ever been used for that?
Not to my knowledge, other than perhaps anecdotal cases. I think one of the concerns is when you have systemic therapy that has demonstrated a survival advantage, you want to make sure you're not compromising a patient in terms of the advantages of systemic therapy. Now, clearly, the surgically resectable patients are a subset that warrants individual attention, but with yttrium, we actually have seen a reduction in tumor size, and it would be a relatively small subset of patients, so I think it would be pretty hard to prospectively assess that population. Currently, what we are seeing, of course, is patients getting combinations of surgery and radiofrequency ablation.
Right, right.
And that's another type of intervention for which there really has been no decent prospective assessment as to what is the impact of taking that type of approach over time. And another example of intervention where we really need to do the prospective clinical trial so that we can define which patients really benefit from combinations such as resection and RFA or RFA alone for limited disease.